Hello and welcome in.
First Science.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio. Good morning. You are listening to Science Mixtape with me, Matilda Hay, and we are coming to you live from Soho Radio's shiny new culture channel and at the new and improved time slot of 12 o'clock. Yes, no more early wake-ups to get your weekly science fix. But on with the show. And this week, it is all about malaria. It's one of the deadliest diseases of the modern world. And as many listeners will know, malaria is a parasite which can get into our blood if we're bitten by an infected mosquito, causing fever, headaches, vomiting, and if untreated, death. Joining me today is Dr. Theo Sanderson from the Wellcome Sanger Institute, whose research focuses on understanding the genome of malaria and working out which genes are important for it to grow and reproduce. Welcome, Theo.
Hi, Matilda.
Good morning. So I just wanted to sort of get the enormity of your task across. Could you tell us how many genes does a malaria parasite have?
So malaria parasites have about 5,000 genes. It varies a bit between species, but that's about the number.
Wow. And you're working at sort of understanding all 5,000 of those.
That's the aim. We haven't got there yet.
Also in the studio, we have producer Kira. Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
And she has a little brain teaser for you.
What is the most dangerous animal in the world?
Indeed. You can tweet us at Science Mixtape if you think you know the answer, and we'll be revealing it at the end of the show. And because it's the new year and it's a new show and a new studio, we've also got Kyle. Good morning, Kyle.
Good morning.
Feeling fresh.
Yeah, feeling fresh. Fresher now. It's a bit later in the day. I've had several cups of coffee to wake me up, so that's better.
And for our experiment this week, if you would like to take part, we are going to be looking at our own cheek cells under the microscope. So if you want to try this yourself, you need to have access to a microscope slide, cotton buds, and some blue dye. But Theo, this is your mixtape. So what is your first song and why?
Okay, so yeah, I basically love any track with some good saxophony, and I think this is one of those. So this was, I think it was originally written as an intro to a bizarre Japanese TV series, but I thought it might be a good introductory track for my mixtape, and it's just a good tune to get people tapping their feet. So this is Tank by Seatbelts.
Affects about 250 million people each year worldwide and kills about 1 million, mostly children in Africa.
Now, there's one thing that I don't... So I understand the symptoms that it gives you, but what? How does malaria kill you? Like, what makes it so dangerous?
So I guess it's a number of things. As you said, a mosquito bites you, it gets its way into your liver initially, and it replicates in there a few times so that it's hidden from the immune system in the liver. It replicates a bunch of times so that a lot of parasites are able to come out. But then...
Wait, what do you mean when you say it's hidden from the immune system in your liver? That sounds very mysterious.
I guess it's inside these cells, and I think the liver is generally this, it's called an immunoprivileged area or something. It's an area where the immune system tends to tolerate stuff more.
I guess because, yeah, the liver's dealing with so many kind of poisons and things
it's
cleaning out. Yeah.
Yeah. So it replicates there a bunch of times, and but ultimately it's got to get to a new person. So to do that, it's got to get out into your bloodstream. And so these parasites break out of the liver, they get into the bloodstream, and then they invade a red blood cell. They replicate lots of times inside that red blood cell, and then they burst out again. And that happens every 48 hours, that they grow in the red blood cell for 48 hours, and then they burst out in these waves. And that's why if you ever have somebody with malaria, they have this periodic fever every 48 hours as those parasites are bursting out.
And come into the blood, and then the body goes, alert,
exactly,
kill these things.
Exactly.
Right, yeah.
So because in general, when they're inside the red blood cell, they're relatively safe and protected. The only point at which they're in danger is if they get to the spleen, because the spleen is actually able to filter out the parasites from the... It just squishes the parasite out of the red blood cells, rather remarkably. So for a parasite, every time it's going round, it's sort of like Russian roulette. If it goes through the spleen rather than another organ, that parasite's done for. So they want to avoid going to the spleen. And to do that, they make a protein that makes the red blood cells really sticky. And so those red blood cells stick in the capillaries and they never make it to the spleen. But it's that process that makes
it
so dangerous.
Causing blood clots in your capillaries.
Basically. And it's when that happens in the brain that is particularly dangerous, because then the blood brain barrier itself can be compromised, and that can cause coma and then death. And yeah,
wow, I had literally no idea that a tiny little parasite from mosquito could wreak so much havoc.
Yeah.
So tell me a bit more about what you do. How do you find out which genes are important for the malaria to grow and reproduce?
So basically, to understand whether a gene is important, you have to do an experiment. So you delete the gene and then you just see what happens. How we delete the genes is basically, you know, we want to delete a particular gene. We'll take a sequence of DNA that is very similar to the genetic sequence around that gene. So it might be the sequence might be gene A and then gene B and then gene C, and we'll basically take that sequence, we'll delete gene B, so it just goes A, C, and we'll make that DNA, we mix it with the parasites, and we give them an electric shock, and then they take up some of that DNA.
Oh, and wow, so you just kind of shock them, and they're like, oh, take in the DNA.
Exactly, it makes little holes in the parasite, and the DNA gets in. And then the parasite sees that there's this sequence which is the same as A, and the sequence that's the same as C, and it basically copies the sequence into the parasite genome, but it's missing the B in the middle. So
because the beginning and the end look the same, it doesn't realise there's anything missing.
Exactly.
Like when you see a word that's spelt wrong in the middle and your brain can still read it because of the beginning and the end being the same.
Yeah. So, but we're trying to that process can be really long and tedious. So we've tried to speed it up by using this barcode sequencing thing, where as we get rid of the B, instead of just getting rid of it, we replace it with a barcode. And that means that barcode uniquely identifies which gene we've deleted. And so we can delete 50 genes in different parasites in the same electric shock. And then we can read out which genes have deleted and what happens by sequencing those genetic barcodes.
Okay, wow. So basically you prepare lots of different bits of DNA with different genes deleted. And then you're going to mix all of these DNAs with loads of parasites, shock them, and they'll take in some of it. Each might take in one or something.
Exactly. And then if we grow the parasites up over time, what we'll see is that that not all of those barcodes that were there at the beginning are there at the end. And the ones that are gone, it means that we deleted a gene and the parasite just died because that gene was deleted. And so that tells us which of the genes are important and which aren't.
Oh, okay. So if you had like 3 barcodes and then when you sequence them, you have loads of barcode 1 and loads of barcode 3, you're like, oh, well, those genes... The parasite's fine, it can survive without those.
Exactly.
But clearly, gene 2 was really important because that's gone and none of those have reproduced. Oh, that's amazing. And what have you found out so far? Anything that kind of really surprises you? Or
I mean, I guess the big picture was just that that a lot of these genes are important. So if you do these big screens, they've been done in lots of different organisms, and normally the vast, vast majority of genes are unimportant. You delete them and nothing really changes, because maybe they were only needed in one very specific situation which you haven't tried, or maybe they're just redundant genes in case another gene fails to do its job. And I think that's what we really expected in malaria, because there are a lot of famous examples of that in malaria. Sometimes if you block it from invading red blood cells in a certain way, it can just find another way of doing it. So we expected to see a lot of redundancy like that. What we actually saw was that 2/3 of the genes were really important for the parasite to grow. And that's interesting, because it means that if we were able to build a drug that bound to the protein that those genes make, we would be able to kill the parasite. So it seems like there are more potential drug targets. Exactly.
Yeah, thousands if it's using 2/3.
Exactly.
Of its genes.
No.
Oh, incredible. Well, on that high note, what is song number 2?
So song number 2 is just a song I really like. And again, one that gets one tapping one's feet. It's Counting Stars by One Republic.
I see this life like a swinging vine. Swing my heart across the line. In my face is flashing signs. Seek it out and ye shall find. Old, but I'm not that old. Young, but I'm not that
feel alive. Baby, I've been losing sleep, dreaming about the things that we could be. Baby, I've been praying hard, said no more counting dollars, we'll be counting stars.
Only female mosquitoes bite humans. Male mosquitoes feed on flower nectar.
And is it true, Theo, you might know this, that they only bite you when they're actually pregnant?
I think that is true, yeah. It's the gravid mosquitoes. Yeah.
Yeah, and they need human blood to, like, feed their growing babies. Sounds a bit like a zombie. Anyway, so we're very excited. As Kira pointed out, we have never had a microscope in the studio before. So thank you very much to Theo for bringing one in. And we are going to actually have a look at our own cheek cells. Our own body cells are obviously really small and you can only really see them under the microscope. So what are we going to do first, Theo?
So I think we're going to, maybe Matilda, you could do this. If you take this cotton bud and I think you just put it in your mouth and just scrape out some cheek cells from sort of just softly across the wall of your cheek and find some cells, and yeah.
And I understand that actually in your mouth your cheek's kind of shedding all the time, a bit like your skin, so
you're not losing too many.
I'm not like scraping it like a rubber brush. I'm literally just kind of rubbing it over the inside of my cheek. I can't see anything on it, but hopefully they'll be there.
Hopefully there's something there. So just just put that on the slide and I will search for my blue dye.
I'm now rubbing my cotton bud over the slide and I've done a little damp circle.
Fantastic. So let's put a little drop of this stuff, which is methylene blue dye. Where should I aim?
I did it in the center.
So yeah, this should hopefully reveal the nuclei inside your cells. So I'm gonna put a cover slip on the top.
Okay. So cover slip is just a really thin, so the microscope slide is like quite a thick, sturdy piece of glass, and then a cover slip is really, really thin piece. I remember working with microscopes at school and the cover slip was what always got broken. So be careful with the cover slip. Glass is dangerous if it breaks. And when you put it on top, what I've seen is that it squashes that droplet of dye and flattens it out, spreading it all over the area where I wiped my saliva and hopefully my cheek cells. And as Theo said, what we're hoping is that this is going to stain the content of the cells, and the biggest part of the cell is the sort of densest part is the nucleus. And so Theo is working away, getting it focused at the moment. Very pleased that he's doing this part because I am terrible at focusing anything.
Doing this under pressure is always slightly nerve-wracking. And I'm just trying to find the bit of the slide where Matilda scraped the cells, because right now I'm just seeing a load of blue.
More in the centre,
I think.
More
in the centre, cool.
Yeah. And so this is a bit of a treasure hunt now. And Theo, you use microscopes quite a lot with your work, don't you?
We do, yeah. So basically, the life of a malaria biologist is sitting in front of the microscope quite a bit. We basically use this technique to count how many of our red blood cells are infected with parasites, and we've got to keep that below about 5% to keep the parasites happy. And so we smear them out on a slide, and we look for infected parasites, and we count the proportion. So I spend most of my time doing that from day to day.
So what am I looking for when I'm looking for my cells, Theo?
So what you would see is a oblong shape of a cell, and then in the middle there's this little blue sphere.
Oh, it's so cool.
Why don't we look at some malaria parasites?
Absolutely. So you grow your parasites in blood, don't you?
We do, exactly. So if you go and donate blood, there is a very, very small chance that I might actually get your blood to grow my malaria parasites in. And so every week we get a bag from the National Blood Service and we use it to grow our parasites. We don't use that much, so it's split between sort of 12 researchers and it lasts us a week. So thank you to blood donors.
Yeah, indeed. So you've got smears of blood on your slides here.
Exactly. Smears of blood stained in the same way. And that reveals the parasites, because the thing is that our red blood cells don't have nuclei. So those nuclei that you find in the cheek cells, and interestingly, bird blood cells do have nuclei, but red blood cells don't. So if you see a little drop of blue inside these cells, then that means that there's a parasite in them, and that allows us to detect what proportion of our cells are infected. So if you look here with bit of imagination, you might see a few of the cells with little blue dots inside.
Yeah, you definitely can.
Great. So those are the parasites. And if you were, we don't quite have the magnification, but if we were to zoom in a bit more, we would see that there are also black dots inside the parasite. And that isn't the stain. That's actually a solid crystal, because as the parasite digests the hemoglobin inside the red blood cells, it turns it into this solid crystal, which is, again, a rather remarkable achievement.
Wow. Yeah, that is so cool. So you would grow your parasite in the blood, and then you are looking at the blood down the microscope to count how many have been infected, and then do you then test for the barcode within the ones that you found?
Essentially, yeah. So what we would do is to take that blood, we extract the DNA from the parasites within it, and then we do this thing called PCR, which specifically amplifies a certain section of the DNA, and that's the section with the barcode in it. And we amplify that, and we put it on a sequencing machine, and that reads out the sort of hundreds of thousands of barcodes, and tells us which genes are important and which genes aren't.
So, Theo, song number three.
Okay, so song number three is based on the fact that I have quite a lot of African colleagues working on malaria, and they've introduced me to African music, including the amazing Malian blues. So Ali Faka Touré and his son have both played this amazing, relaxing blues music. This is by Vieux Faka Touré, and it's called Fafa, which means brotherhood.
Mosquitoes are attracted to the carbon dioxide, lactic acid and acetanol found in our breath and sweat, and they also sense the heat and humidity that surrounds our bodies. They may also have a preference for beer drinkers.
Maybe this is why they like some people more than others. Not just the beer part, but the lactic acid and the sweat. Mm. I always thought it was if you ate loads of sugar, then you had like really sweet tasting blood and they'd come after you.
That's what I assumed as well, because I always get bitten by mosquitoes.
Yeah, me too.
There are some amazing experiments for this where they force people to wear these horrible socks, plastic socks, for like 2 days and just collect all of their odours. And then they put one of the socks in, they give the mosquito a choice between two socks in different chambers, and the mosquitoes fly towards one or the other, and they work out which one is the most tasty.
Wow, I'm really glad I'm not doing that research. Spending my life with other people's smelly socks. So what got you interested in malaria in the first place, Theo?
So, I mean, when I was starting my PhD, I didn't really know what I wanted to do, and committing 3 years of my life to a very specific research project without trying it seemed scary. So I did some rotations in different labs, and one of them I tried, probably just because I didn't know anything about it, was malaria. And And they're just really fascinating organisms because, you know, they're not bacteria, they're not viruses, they're actually more related to us, and they're even more related to sort of algae. So they have this chloroplast, which chloroplast-like organelle, which shows that they used to be photosynthetic. And in general, as eukaryotes, they have this very complicated machinery which allows them to do really interesting things. So I enjoyed studying that.
Wow, I had no idea they had a chloroplast. Like, that's
crazy. They don't use it for photosynthesis anymore, obviously. Not much sunlight in your blood, but they do some metabolism with it.
A bit like us having our appendix that we don't use anymore. Ah, and what would you say are the challenges of the research that you do?
Well, apart
from there being 5,000 genes and it's like a mammoth task.
Yeah, I mean, my life, it's rather counterintuitive because most people are trying to kill malaria and so on. My life is about keeping my malaria parasites alive and desperately trying to do that, sometimes failing. And so there's a bunch of potential challenges. I mean, The parasite, one of the parasites that I study, is a relative.
Because there's actually four types of malaria parasite, aren't there?
Yeah, I mean, there's now six actually. The number's going up and up, but it depends what you call a species and so on. But the one that I study, one of the ones that I study, it's a relative of a one that used to be really big in Africa, like many, 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 many years ago, and then humans in Africa evolved to stop making the receptor on their red blood cell that the parasite used to get inside that red blood cell, and so the parasite isn't found anywhere in Africa and it can't grow in the blood of African people. But as I said, our blood just comes from the National Blood Service. Occasionally it will come from somebody of African descent and then my parasites will just die and I'll have no real idea why. So there's a bunch of challenges.
And this is the perfect time. So we always like to ask people for their fieldwork faux pas, something that's maybe gone a little wrong or at the time you thought it was going to be a disaster and it's now just a funny story.
Mine, I guess it wouldn't be in the field, but it was a bit of an incident in the lab. So when we freeze our parasites, if I'm going on holiday or something and I don't want to keep the parasites alive, I'll put them in the freezer. And to do that, we want to freeze them very quickly. So we make...
Are you able to defrost them afterwards?
You are.
So it's like cryogenics for a parasite.
But exactly. We mix acetone with dry ice, and that's one of, you know, there are some bits in science which are fun because they sort of look like science, and so it's really cold, so it's this frothing, steaming bath of acetone mixed with dry ice. So I'd made this in this plastic container, and for some reason it wasn't quite the right shape or whatever, so I decided I needed to pour it into another container, and so I saw this other container that was made of polystyrene, and that was my error, because Matilda, I've got actually here a little tube of acetone.
Should I hold one for you?
Okay, if you hold the tube of acetone, and I will just now take this little bit of polystyrene and drop it in, and you can sort of see.
Oh my god, it's gone. It's like now just it looks like a little white foam on top. You had a chunk that was just like 2 centimeters big, and it is now. Here we go. Here's another.
Yeah.
It literally dissolves. Oh, my God.
It dissolves quite well in acetone. And it turns out that means that polystyrene is not such a good container to store acetone, particularly when it's full of dry ice. So that was unfortunate.
Were you holding it in your hands? Was it on a table?
It was on a table. And unfortunately, it sort of had some sort of lining such that there was one tiny bit that didn't fully dissolve, and so I was able to get it to the sink, but it was slightly unfortunate.
Oh, and all your parasites on the floor.
The parasites weren't in there yet, thankfully.
Oh, okay, good. Just acetone on the floor.
Just acetone, a bit of dry ice.
That is amazing. How do you find working with stuff that you can't see? Like, I mean, we just had an example there of looking at the cells, and they're so small, but the parasite itself, if you, like, need to see that, like, even tinier.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, the parasites are so the cheek cells are a certain size, the red blood cells are probably a tenth of the size of cheek cells maybe, and the parasites are even smaller than that. And I guess science is, a lot of science, there's some famous quote from somebody that, it's about making the invisible visible. And so it's about finding ways to see these things. One of the ways is by actually sequencing the DNA so that you don't have to look at it. You can just measure the letters of it. And we're also using these clever techniques called super resolution microscopy, where one of the limitations is literally the wavelength of light that you're using to look at the parasites. Parasites are only a few, they're not that many wavelengths big. And but by using these techniques, you can actually image at even higher resolution than that limit of the wavelength of light. And that allows us to see some of these structures that we otherwise couldn't.
Yeah, I feel like for me, it would take such a sort of leap of imagination to be like, this thing that I'm seeing blown up on a screen is actually like tiny in someone's blood cells. Theo, time for song number four.
Okay, well, I mean, I think this has all been about the confessions about life in the lab. And I guess one of the confessions is that, you know, we scientists are meant to be sort of these masters of rationality, but we can easily get quite superstitious. And some of these malaria experiments take months after you do the experiment before you know the result. So we have all these little rituals about what you need to do to make the experiment work. I heard about a lab where they only used Evian mineral water for their transfections. So there's a lot of weirdness, and as a tribute to that, and just because it's a great song, this is Superstition by Stevie Wonder.
I'm just gonna, as it starts, Theo, do you have any superstitions that you adhere to?
I normally do my transfections at a certain time of day. I think they'll probably work.
Malaria is one of the world's oldest diseases, with evidence of the illness in tissues from ancient Egyptian mummies.
News just in. Theresa May announces a 25-year war on plastic.
German scientists keep journal access without paying.
Your immune system may stop you receiving gene therapy.
Solar panel cells with genetically modified algae could one day power rural Africa.
Scientists may have found a black hole.
Humans possess antibodies against CRISPR proteins.
Well, a very awesome range there. Kira, kick us off.
Yeah, so very interesting. I'm going to steal Theo's bit because I think we prepared the same bit. But so there's this tool called CRISPR, which scientists have been using to edit genomes, basically. And it originated in a bacterium. So when they now use it in humans, because we don't actually produce the protein called Cas9, which is part of the CRISPR machinery, it's thought that our immune system is actually going to... created a inflammation because of the Cas9 protein that's originally from bacteria. So then this would essentially stop people receiving gene therapy, and we wouldn't be able to use CRISPR to correct genes because we don't make those proteins.
I saw that one of the companies that has developed this technology, their share price dropped 10% just on the release of that paper. That's rather amazing.
Yeah, so quite scary.
I thought when they've said, "Oh, CRISPR's going to like revolutionize gene therapy," I thought they'd already been doing trials.
So they have. They've done it in like worms and flies and things like that, and they have done human clinical trials as well.
And that's how they found that actually it causes inflammation.
Yeah, so I think now they're trying to manipulate the immune system, so that we won't produce an immune response to the CRISPR machinery. But it's not safe at the minute anyway.
Wow.
Yeah.
Part of me is like, it's obviously going to be really great technology when we get it, but kind of good that we can't so easily meddle with ourselves. And
yeah, it's a bit playing God, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. I've been reading too much Sapiens.
I think it also, it'll still be really useful for research, like, you know, to be able to look at things. And there'll be other techniques that are going to be developed that which will use other proteins and other things. So,
and I don't think we can rule it out just yet. I mean, this is an early study, and as long as you're expressing it inside a cell, then it may be safe from the immune system. So I don't think it's clear yet.
True. It could be hiding in an immune-privileged area, just like the malaria. Theo, tell me more about your story, the German scientists.
So mine's a kind of meta story. So scientists have got ourselves right in this weird position where we do cool science, and then rather than just sharing it with each other, we keep it secret for now, and we send it to a journal that sort of secretly peer reviews it. And then it can take between a month and several years for it to get published, and then the journal charges scientists huge amounts of money to read it. So Elsevier is one of the biggest of these companies. It owns about 2,500 journals and has these profit margins of 30%. And recently, a group of German universities got together and sort of said, unless you give us a discount, we're not going to renew our contract for 2018. So there was this sort of standoff coming up to the year. And the standoff has continued, and they still haven't agreed a discount. But Elsevier has said, okay, scientists, for now, you can keep access. And I think that's kind of interesting, because it could mean that they're just being very magnanimous and being nice, but it could also be that they sort of realise that if they
an archaic model, isn't it?
Yeah, and maybe if they pull the access, German scientists will just stop publishing in those journals and just start sharing their papers.
And they might lose their credibility. And yeah, I mean, there's a whole move towards open access, isn't there?
Yeah. So changing times.
I think it's because, you know, you've got the internet, right? You don't need a centralized body now to distribute papers.
Yeah,
anything can just be put on to a server that one person can
manage. Google Scholar's already doing a lot of that, aren't they?
Yeah, and depends on the field, right? The archive, which is a huge resource, which is papers just put on there. More and more in certain fields, papers are primarily put on the internet for free, and then everyone else can just read them.
Yeah, so many scientists might have their own papers as PDFs on their own website page.
Yeah, definitely. Or they certainly have links to like archive papers that are like, it's supposed to be a preprint archive, as in it goes up there before it gets published somewhere else. But in some fields, like in high energy physics, there's a kind of a drive to, once it's on the archive, it's kind of published, so everyone just references it from there. So there's like this move to this open science, which I think is pretty good.
Yeah,
it's great.
I'm also a big fan. So I was really excited when I saw this headline, Theresa May announces the 25-year war on plastic, because anyone who's watched Blue Planet recently or been sort of reading any environmental news, we know like plastic something's got to change. There's just too much and we're killing our oceans. And so her 25-year plan includes eliminating all avoidable plastic waste, if possible. And her proposed policies include plastic-free aisles in supermarkets and a tax on takeaway containers, as well as extending the 5p plastic bag tax to smaller supermarkets. I didn't realise in England it's only on supermarkets with 200 employees or more. Okay. But in Scotland and Wales, they're already like way ahead of us, and they already have it everywhere. And this is the thing. So actually, although it sounds really great in a headline, loads of people are criticising it, saying actually it contains really weak proposals and it's just a cynical attempt to rebrand the Tories' image, because everyone's like more concerned about the environment now and they think it's going to get them more votes. Greenpeace, for example, have said, well, you haven't even included a deposit return scheme for plastic bottles, and that's been shown to work in other countries and is quite easy to implement. And it's easy to promise things that another government will have to deliver by saying it's going to happen in 25 years. So who knows? Great that, you know, at least people are talking about it. And hopefully more pressure will be put on the government and we'll get some better proposals.
Yeah.
Any more?
So, scientists in the University of Amsterdam think that they may have found a black hole. So they've been measuring radio waves from the Archibald telescope in Puerto Rico. And the radio waves seem to be twisting, because there's a huge magnetic field that's apparently 200 times bigger than the magnetic field in our Milky Way galaxy, and this turns the radio waves into spirals. So they think that they might have detected a black hole, basically.
That's
I'm not
really
a physicist,
cool.
but that's my understanding.
Throw to Kyle.
Of what goes on.
I have not read this story. but I mean, I think they must be looking at the polarization of the...
yeah.
of the light, essentially. And a big magnetic field can like do funny things to that. So the massive magnetic field like messes up the light signals that you're looking at, changes the polarization.
Right, okay.
And that can be evidence for something like that. Okay. I guess the magnetic field could come from something else, though. Not sure what else would make a magnetic field quite that big, but hey.
Yeah, I...
Well, more research from me and more research from them, I think.
And on that mystery, let's go to Theo's fifth song.
Okay, so I also have a real fondness for film soundtracks as a genre of music. And I think that they're very good to listen to when I'm culturing because, I don't know, they don't have too much extraneous content. They're just sort of background music, but they're fantastic. And there are so many master composers of film soundtracks, but I have gone for the theme to The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly by Ennio Morricone.
The genome of the mosquito which carries the Zika virus was finally completely mapped just last year after the critical outbreak of Zika in 2015 and 2016.
So where are you at in your genome mapping?
So I guess it depends how you look at it. So we've been focusing initially on this blood stage of the infection, which, as you've mentioned, is the most deadly in terms of causing disease in patients. And there we've managed to understand what happens when you delete about half of the genes, so about 2,500 genes, a little more than that. For technical reasons, the other ones may be a bit harder and may take a bit longer, but that's one of the things we're working on. And obviously, it's a big team. I'm just one little cog in that system. We also want to understand other stages of the parasite, and we've already sort of moved on to understanding some of these genes in other stages. So the parasites, they reproduce sexually inside the mosquito. So a small number of the parasites in your blood decide to become male or to become female. And we don't really know how they do that. That's one of the things that we want to try to understand.
So some of them just stay kind of asexual the whole time?
Some of them stay asexual the whole time. And then they can keep reproducing and reproducing and reproducing. But a small proportion just go off to become male or female in the hope that a mosquito will pick them up.
And so what are your plans for the future in terms of this?
Yeah, so we'd also like to understand their progress once they become those forms, how they go through the mosquito, which genes are important in that process. And we've got collaborations to understand that, to try to understand that.
Does this mean you're going to have to get samples of mosquito blood from mosquito donors?
that's exactly right. I mean, we have collaborators in Switzerland who are actually driving forward that part of the research. So we send off some blood to Switzerland, and they feed that blood to mosquitoes over there. So that's cool. And then we also want to understand the liver stages of the infection again, which genes are important for that. But then another, that all relies on this barcode sequencing approach, which is great, but it means that you can't like look at a particular parasite. Like you said, you're only seeing it by measuring the barcode. You can't actually see that parasite and know which gene has been deleted in it. So to be able to do that, you have to have lots and lots and lots of parallel cultures, or each with one gene deleted. And so that's one of the things I'm trying to drive forwards at the moment, using robots to allow us to culture many hundreds of parasites or thousands of parasites at the same time without one experimenter going completely mad.
And when you say robots, do you mean just like lots and lots of robotic arms, not just like you doing all of the...
Yeah, cultures? I mean, it's a little thing that... So we do all this culture inside these hoods, which like have clean air in them. And it's a little thing that sits in there. It has one... It literally has like a robotic thumb that pushes down on a pipette, and it moves that pipette around, and it removes waste media from the parasites, adds some fresh media with new nutrients, keeps them happy.
That's great. Do you think we will ever completely eradicate malaria as we have done with smallpox?
That's a great question. I mean, it's such a focus of funding from Bill Gates and so on. And you know, it's at the moment 500,000 people a year are dying of malaria. It's a huge problem. We used to have malaria in England,
really?
In Cambridge, where I was, where I work. 50 years ago, 100 years ago, there was malaria around. So if you look at the map of places where malaria is, it's dramatically dropped. But these last major places, sub-Saharan Africa and areas of Asia and South America, they're going to be really challenging because the conditions are just so well suited to the parasite that it's a lot harder. So trying to develop vaccines is a big push, and there's a vaccine that's being trialed, but it's not very effective at the moment, and trying to develop effective vaccines would be really good. And then there's this stuff about trying to wipe out the mosquitoes that actually carry the parasites, which also could be cool.
And is that, are they doing that with something like a gene drive?
Yeah, that's right. So again, this is using the CRISPR that we were talking about earlier. So clearly, mosquitoes don't have too many antibodies against CRISPR proteins. And so they use that CRISPR system to basically cause a particular gene to be super well transmitted, so that both copies, both... Rather than you getting one, rather than the child mosquito having one copy of the gene from its mother and one copy of the gene from its father, it has both copies from one parent, and this gene is transmitted really well. And they're using that to try to make basically all of the mosquitoes male, because like you said, it's the female mosquitoes that carry the disease. And also, if you don't have any females, you can't have
reproduce.
A species.
That's a really crafty and creative way of getting rid of the mosquito. Wow. Oh, fascinating. Thank you so, so much for joining us today, Theo. It's been so interesting.
Thanks for having me.
Do you have any guesses for our brain teaser? In fact, Kira, do you want to remind our listeners what the brain teaser was?
Yeah, so the brain teaser today was, what is the world's most deadliest animal?
So I've heard something about hippos.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I think it was a hippo.
No. Hippos are much more aggressive than you might think. I love this question because straight away you think of the animals with the big teeth and the sharp claws that, you know, in all the stories are the man killers. But actually, what is the animal that carries a deadly parasite that
I'm
kills half a million?
Myself.
I thought you'd know this straight away. It is, of course, the mosquito. That's a good one for your pub quiz trivia. And finally, Theo, what are we going to play out on?
Okay, so talking about my dreams, which are to have robots doing malaria research better than humans, this is some robots performing a song, Harder, Better, Faster, Stronger by Daft Punk.
Join us again next week in 2 weeks' time. Science Mixtape is now bi-weekly, 12 o'clock on Soho Radio Culture. Work it, make it, do it, makes us harder, better, faster, stronger. For more Science Mixtape, you can find our shows on Audioboom, iTunes, or any other podcast provider.